Welcome to Always Searching, the podcast challenging conventional wisdom about health and wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. I'm delighted that you're here. What if there's a better way to realistically transform our lives? I intend to find out by challenging conventional wisdom in health and wellness. I'm a physician, teacher, entrepreneur, author, and a disruptor. As a leader in women's health, precision innovation, and space medicine, I've dedicated my life to improving health on Earth and in space for everyone. I've taken a very non-traditional path through life, including traveling to every continent on this planet, while exploring the political and psychosocial environments that shape our health decisions. Now, I am always searching not just for a new destination, but for answers to tough questions which can help us to maintain wellness even in times of stress and trouble. I bet all of us are searching for this. I am very excited about this new journey, and I hope you'll join me along the way. My guest today is an entrepreneur, change agent, and visionary leader. She's living an extraordinary life, from a ballerina to a television producer to working with Daymond John from the Shark Tank to being the founder and the CEO of the Cavu Group. Welcome to the show, Always Searching, Leslie Short.
Hello there. So nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. You have had an incredible journey. What I'd like to do is just bring our listeners along with us and learn a little bit more about you. First, how did you become a ballerina? What was the start of that?
I was not the little girl that said, oh, I want to dance. I was chosen to do a quick performance when we lived in New York, but unfortunately, we were about to move. So I did the performance, but I couldn't be trained. They asked my parents, could they train me? When we moved to New Jersey, we just so happened to move a couple doors down from a retired dancer who saw me playing outside, asked my parents, could she take me to an audition? That they were auditioning Pennsylvania Ballet, auditioning little girls to be classical ballet dancers, to be trained. And my parents were like, ask her, good luck with that. And she did, and I didn't know anything about being a ballerina or ballet.
At age seven.
But I went, and I was always creating in my mind things, jumping and turning and twisting. Of course, they all have French ballet terms, but in my head, I had made them all up. And long story short, out of many girls, they chose 30. Out of 30, they chose three, and I was one of the three that was chosen to be trained as a classical ballet dancer.
And you were 7 years old when you started. How did that influence your childhood and your adolescence?
Oh, everything. I turned professional at the age of 12. Wow. I think it had to be the age of 8 when I probably giggled in class. And my teacher looked at me and pulled me aside, and I was the only Black girl in class. And she said, the other girls' parents will pay their way in. Your parents can afford to pay your way into a company, but they won't. So therefore, you are also so much more talented than they are. Don't play around in class. And that set the tone to how I run everything now.
Wow. So it really set the standard. And, you know, it's such an important time in a young girl's life, especially with body image, self-esteem issues. How did it impact you?
Well, number one, ballet is a world among itself. So you're in your own bubble. Mm-hmm. And you're never too thin. You can be too tall. You can always be too heavy. Your feet can't be arched enough. Like, there's so many things. It's all about your body. You know, years ago, and they probably still do it now, in order to be accepted into a ballet school or into a program or scholarship, they needed to look at your mother. And depending on your mother's body would depend on if you were accepted or not.
Wow. So you were assessed by your lineage and your history and your ancestry. Wow.
Absolutely. So I was, you know, my mom didn't take me to the audition. The next door neighbor took me to the audition, but my mother was billed as the Black Marilyn Monroe. So her body now and then was always beautiful and always shapely. I did not get that because dancing stunts your growth.
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, you see with our young gymnasts and our figure skaters, did you have any injuries while you were a ballerina? And does that impact your life today?
Oh, I stayed in the emergency room, and we knew the nurses and doctors, and they would laugh and ask my parents, are you sure she's not playing football? That she's not sneaking off? I think I have sprained so many things, broken so many things. And absolutely, if it affects how I walk, I still have to stretch. I have scoliosis of the spine and neck, which is getting, you know, worse as I've gotten older. It wasn't bad then, but now it is affecting me. My hips, my feet, you name it. I know when it's raining 10 states over.
That's incredible. I mean, it's literally like a disability. Workwoman's compensation should be provided for ballerinas.
No such thing.
Do you still dance for joy today? You know, if you hear a song on the radio, do you just get up and start moving, or are you just done with it?
Oh, it's all in my head. It's always. I mean, yeah. People that know me will laugh and like, oh, she's about to start twirling. And because it's natural. Now, I won't do it in a crowd, but I will definitely break out and dance and break out in and twirling, because, hey, that's what I'm used to.
You know, there's really interesting data that shows that people who dance actually have more improved cognition, that their dendrites and their neurons are all connected. Do you find that dancing has impacted just even the way you see the world?
Yes. When you are being trained, that's all you're supposed to look at, the world of dance. You're never told that you can do anything else. You don't normally go to college. You're very focused. There's a big difference of being good at 16 and being good at 17. A world of difference.
Wow, that's impressive.
And so you are always focused on what you have to do. I was always someone that when it was break time, I hung out with the crew. Whether it was the lighting crew or the stage crew, I never hung out with the dancers, and I was always learning something else. And it intrigued me how it all came together in the theater. And that's how I've handled my life. I don't walk in and just say, what do I have to do? I go, how does it all come together?
Wow, so you're really seeing it in multiple dimensions. And that's probably helped you to build your companies and to work with that diversity of talent, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, because I also understand that you need to understand from the mailroom to the boardroom what's going on in order to be able to, when you're asking for something or executing something, how is it going to play out, not only for yourself, but for others?
Wow. So the whole element of teamwork, you know, I was reading your bio and it said that you were part of the J-Men's Tokyo, which was named the fourth best business venture in Japan, and where you produced, directed, and choreographed the first male review show in Japan. I mean, my mind is going to many places right now. So do you want to tell us what that meant?
So when I retired from dancing, I was living in Japan. And that was the last show that I did a full show of dancing. Mm-hmm. But I used to pass by this building and I saw that building. And I said, that's my theater. I used to always say, that's my theater. In my head, I had the music. I had the choreographer. I had everything, but I didn't have the money. And I'm an American Black woman living in Japan. So you need to have Japanese business partners to own anything in Japan. And we went to dinner at the boss's house one night, and her husband came in, who was her business partner. And I said to her, did you tell him what I wanted? And he started to run. He's like, oh no, what does Leslie want now? This is going to be trouble. But he heard me out and he started asking questions. How much are the tickets? What color? What this? What that? And I had all the answers because I already had it in my head. And my friends that were dancers that were there that night said, you went from one of us to one of them in a matter of 5 minutes. And the only thing that was required of me was to name it a J, because all their businesses had a J. His wife, first name was J, started with J. And I'm like, that's it? And he's like, yes, go to America, go to Australia, go to London, go wherever you want, make it successful. That was my requirement.
So you were given your mission and you already had it in your mind how you were going to go from point A to B and C, but how did you get others to come along with you?
I knew what I wanted.
That's important.
And I was clear on what I wanted. And so to have one of the other dancers that sewed, she came on to help with costumes. It gave her a new opportunity to use one of her other skills. I was clear on how I wanted the set design. I knew how to do the lighting. I was editing music. I don't edit music, but I was editing music because I had enough skills from other theaters of learning from editors and sound engineers. And I just was very clear on the audience of who I was going to be speaking to as well, and what they were ready for, not what I was ready to give.
So how'd you know that? I mean, especially you were dealing in a multicultural environment. You were coming in really not looking like everybody, having a unique experience as a ballerina. How did you know what someone else wanted, and how did you know how to convey that message?
Twofold. One, a lot of women would come to the show. And they, if you know anything about the Japanese culture, they become fans very quickly. They like you, they become a fan. But also, as the Black American girl walking around Roppongi and Shirajuku and everything, shopping, I used to get followed.
Really?
And I would say, if you're going to follow me, you're going to help me shop.
Well, that's clever.
And little by little, I would say, what do you do for fun? And they would say, karaoke and dinner. I'm like, no, what do you do for fun? It's just for you. And they started to tell me. And I realized there was a huge hole in the marketplace. I know that another company, very well known, had tried to come to Japan, but they wanted it to be about them, their brand. This is what we do. But they did not take into consideration the audience and culture for which they were speaking to.
So important. So you almost had your own built-in focus group.
Oh, I did.
To help guide you. And then this first mail review, you know, again, as I say, my mind's going into a particular place. But what did they do? What was their entertainment?
They were all dancers and singers, many of them from Broadway, out of ballet companies, out of, I came back to New York, I auditioned dancers from Broadway and cruise ships and then the London Ballet, I had a guy. I always had one guy that was like the Adonis kind of looking guy. As in my chippy nose. But it was a full review show, dance show, singing. And they only went to a G-string. It was catered towards the audience. And as the audience grew, the numbers grew a little bit. But it was theater. And it was something, listen, I had death threats. People were saying I was changing the culture.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Men were upset. Then when women start going and coming home happy, I started receiving gifts.
Saved a lot of marriages.
I saved a lot of marriages and a lot of things. Once everyone settled down and realized that this wasn't any worse than going to a Broadway show.
Just a different setting. And you were able to change the culture by bringing people along with you. So sound like you loved it. How did you get back into New York and now work with Montel Williams as his TV producer? That's quite a jump.
Yeah, this story of my life, I don't mind jumping and moving.
Huge jumps.
At some point, I had been living out of the country for 13 and a half years, 10 and a half in Europe, still dancing, ballet, theater, doing film, doing television. Had the opportunity to go to Japan, was there for 3.5 years as a dancer and then as the owner, part owner of the theater. Came home to visit, which I had not been home in probably 6 or 7 years just because of my schedule. Was at my parents and saw Maya Angelou and Oprah on television. I said, okay, America, you have two Black women sitting here. Maybe you do know what to do with me now. Yeah. Maybe I'm not exotic, as you would say. I can't figure it out. Right. And I came back and I said, I want to produce for television. Well, TV said, no, thank you. Where's your communications degree? And I'm like, I have been producing for the last, I don't know how many
years
in Europe.
That's unbelievable.
But they didn't care.
They wanted a degree, not the experience.
Right. And I said, okay. And I had an internship after owning my own business in Japan. I came back and interned at Channel 13. In that building, Montel Williams' show was being filmed. And I danced with one of his ex-wives now and ran into her. And she's like, all I can do is introduce you. I can't do anything else. And so my resume, and I'm like, well, okay, this is really unique. And I started as a PA, as a production assistant. And I was a production assistant, I think, for 2 weeks or 3 weeks before I was promoted. When they realized, oh, you know what you're doing.
You have some experience. Did you have any idea what you wanted to do with him? I mean, when I think of Montel Williams, I think certainly, you know, as an entertainer, but he's also been a passionate advocate about his issues with multiple sclerosis, about certain medications, including cannabis. Was any of this part of it at that time?
No. At the time, I was there is when he discovered he had MS. Mm-hmm. I don't even think it was truly diagnosed until a little bit after I left. But we stayed in touch for years, became friends, and were able to do other business things together when I was at FUBU and other partners. And we really had a relationship beyond just boss. And it's because of his wife at the time as well. Mm-hmm. We were able to do other business things. But no, he was just being diagnosed at that time.
So when you were working with him, were you, in your mind, because it sounds like that's where you germinate all your phenomenal ideas, were you already thinking about the next steps and the next place where you wanted to be?
I was already thinking about what's next, for the simple reason is I was able and really blessed to be able to do some special reporting and working on news segments, which is, anyone knows me, knows I love news. But I couldn't tell a woman that her rape story wasn't good enough to be on TV.
Yeah.
That it wasn't sensational enough, or I'm sorry, your family only had so many murdered and this is the strongest story. And it was news story. They weren't sensational, right. But it was still that fact that that was part of it. Mm-hmm. I was never one of the producers, now I'm really going to date myself, that ran to the fax machine the next day to see what their numbers were and what their ratings were. I was the producer that went out and bought a pair of shoes.
So you cared about the human being. You cared about the personal side of that.
Yes.
So what I, speaking of that, you moved from that and then you did so many other things. I mean, you worked at Macy's. I think you said JCPenney's, that, you were wearing Gucci and JCPenney's and interns weren't supposed to wear Gucci. I mean, it's just an incredible transformation. How are you able to do that?
Well, Macy's was the special events department. And so that's theater, that we did events. We produced events. We did celebrity appearances. We did fashion shows. I was able to take my theater background and build events and do them with a different flair than what the store was used to doing. With some pushback, a lot of pushback. But at the end of the day, when they saw it all come together, they saw it made sense. They saw that my events were getting press and that they were unique and different, still in the guideline of what it needed to be, but outside of what was expected. And, I did that and it was great. And I was like, okay, next, done it. I worked corporate America. Now I know how to go into other retail stores. I understand what it means to work with the luggage department or jewelry department or the executives. I was part of the exec team and make those decisions in a corporate retail setting. And to the point that when I did leave and get the opportunity to go to FUBU, which was the next move, everyone told me I was making the biggest mistake of my career.
Why did they say that?
Four young Black men that own the company. They were like, it's hip hop. That's not you. Mm-hmm. You're not one of them. And I kept saying, who are them? No one would answer me, but let's just call it what it is. It was four young Black men that owned the company, mm-hmm. but I saw myself in them.
You were with Damon John for, 20 years? And you spent 10 years as, the president of marketing, advertising, and PR for FUBU?
Yes.
How did that come about?
I produced an event for our FUBU and LL Cool J at Macy's.
And they kept
saying, and I'm going to call his name, Keith, because he always wants credit for it. Keith.
Good, Keith.
Karen.
Right.
We need to hire someone like her. We need someone like her. And I said, you know what? I don't know anything about hip hop. That's not my world. You want tea, you want, French, you want muscles, That's the world I've been living in. And to Damon's credit, he said, I don't need you to know that. We have that. We can share that with you. You're bringing Time and Newsweek and CNN and mm-hmm. all these other magazines and outlets and the way that you work. That's where we're trying to move to. You've worked with Calvin Klein and you've worked with all these other companies producing events for them and you understand how they move through these systems. That's what we need.
So you were able to find, or actually they were able to find you and they saw inside you what you could provide them. What did you see in them that was going to be an asset for you?
I saw myself. I saw myself making the deal in Japan mm-hmm. and everyone doubting mm-hmm. whether it will work or not. But every time I asked them Do you have a photo? Do you have a blow up? Do you have a video reel of this? The answer may have been no. When do you need it? And it would be to me. And I would ask some of the bigger designers for those same elements for their event. Not like I'm taking it home. And they'd be like, oh, come on, Leslie, do you really need that? Oh, I have to pull it. I'm going to have to get a request. And I'm like, this is for you. This is not for me.
So you took all those years of experience in Japan and translated it into an entirely different environment and made it work.
Absolutely.
But what was some of the biggest challenges? Because, I mean, a totally different culture, language, everything. So what was one of the biggest challenges you faced? Because it had to be hard.
I mean, it was definitely a different way of working. I mean, you come into an office and there's music blasting and designers are on that side and salesmen are yelling on that side. And I'm walking in with a marketing plan and can we, you know, I would love to be able to do this. And they just look at me and go, can you do it? And I'm like, yes. And they're like, but what's my budget? Go make it happen. Oh, what?
You're lucky to have that.
Yes. And so they were like, if you can make it happen. But that was the mentality and the mentality of Damon and the entire FUBU team, that you were hired to do what you do, not what we think you can do. So if you said you can do it, then make it happen. And I had autonomy to really push the envelope. My challenges was when I was speaking with press and they would want to call it ghetto or hip hop or urban. And I refused to allow that to happen because if we were sitting in the stores next to Donna Karan and Calvin Klein and Ralph, you know, or Polo, and you weren't calling them urban or hip hop, is it because there's four black men that own the company that you've decided it has to be under a different category? No, you will treat us as young men's fashion. And that was my fight until I finally had them listed under young men's.
So you really knocked down those walls. You had to change people's perceptions.
Absolutely.
Which is, it sounds like you've been doing that your entire life. I mean, it's just never been, you know, this straight, easy path. So when Damon moved towards the Shark Tank and began to scale that up, what was your connection to all that?
I was gone by that point, but let's be clear, before I left with all of the owners, I asked, what would you like to do? And I had all of them in acting classes and I had all of them in commercial classes and they were media trained from day one. And because my goal was, you will never just be in one spot. You can decide which way you want to take your career. You will always be ready to step in front of a camera or to sit in a meeting and make those deals the way that you want to make them. And they, so those were skills that they had. So I was not surprised when, you know, Damon started doing more TV interviews and then getting Shark Tank and doing different deals. And he would call me back. Like, I left on a Friday. On Monday, he called me back to help close a different deal. We always stayed in touch. We do to this day. And I, you know, I had gone back a couple of years ago and helped him build an executive workspace in the city, a 20,000 square workspace that I designed and ran that business.
I remember being there when you were just launching it. It was extraordinary.
So, you know, there's always, we will always have that connection. And I know you don't say your family at work, but we became a family unit, all of us, because we spent so much time together.
Of course. Of course. You know, one of the things I loved when I was talking to you about iGiant, which is my nonprofit, which is an accelerator for gendered innovation. And you told me, you know, just go big, focus on every sector. Don't think small. And then you gave an example about a standing desk and it wasn't electronic. It was too hard to move up and down and funding was withheld. And I love that because you saw, you know, how what you could do could benefit everyone, but you had to think big.
Yes, it's think big and then work smart.
So when one's working smart, that's always an interest. Working smart, you know, everyone can interpret it from their own lens. To you, what is working smart?
What's in front of me today? What do I need to achieve? How does it move me forward? Maybe it doesn't. Maybe I just need to get this done. But what can I learn from this that will move me forward then?
So how has that influenced what you're doing now? Now you are the founder and CEO of the Covet Group. It's an acronym. I'd love for you to share with us what it is and your website. And how did you go from, you know, being that little ballerina living in all these wonderful places around the globe to now doing this?
Well, before I did this, I actually owned KI, and I still own KI Media LLC, which is an event and branding firm.
Okay.
So I was designing events and producing events and doing a lot of Asian cultural events and European events. Companies where it come from Europe or Asia and want to launch here in the States. Mm-hmm. And I would be the agency that was hired because I understood culture.
Is that where the culturally curious component comes in here?
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
So that was always being built because I was able to design these events for cultural relevant holidays that you would maybe not see a face like mine being the person responsible for that.
Yeah.
And so from that, it's building that, building businesses with Damon and other celebrities and other companies led me to the Cargo Group. One, because I was exhausted hearing the words diversity and inclusion being tossed around as buzzwords. Three, everyone kept saying to me it was so hard to do when I was working as a corporate operations strategist, coming into people's companies, finding the open holes where they could do jobs better, who should be let go, who should be hired. How do you build a culture beyond ping pong? I was already doing those types of things. And now to bring it all in, and don't tell me you can't find Black, brown, or women, those with disabilities, sight seen and unseen, to do jobs. Mm-hmm. And I said, I didn't see the conversation in meetings and hear the conversations in meetings. And I didn't see it being built the way that I want it to work in DEI. And so I built it myself. How I want it to work and how I want it to be able to work with companies and give to them true, committable, sustainable, attainable action steps that's part of a very long journey.
So, you know, you're so right about we use these as buzzwords, diversity, inclusion, equity. Companies sort of check it off the box. That usually sometimes means somebody, person of color, or as you mentioned, disability, or maybe even age or gender sitting at the table. But how do you know, how does a company really know that it's achieved this? And how do you help get them from being committed, it's in their head, to actually having those actionable items?
Well, most, I won't say that committable is in their head. Committable is on a checklist, mm-hmm. either being pushed by staff,
right,
or it's what we need to do.
Right.
And then there are others that are truly committed. And those are the ones that really want to work and understand that it's a journey and that I'm going to look at everything. I'm going to look at handbooks. I'm looking at policy and procedure. I'm looking at how you hire, where you hire, who's sitting in the room when there's being interviewed. What is the inclusive language? And we're breaking down everything. It's not performative.
So have you seen in the last few months, perhaps more backlash as some of the dialogue gets confusing for people?
I don't think it's backlash. We went through, jump on a bandwagon. Oh my goodness, I didn't know this was happening. Oh my God, mm-hmm. oh my God, oh my right. God. We saw a man be killed on TV. We have to make changes mm-hmm. to... Oh, this is, I'm ally fatigue. Oh, I didn't know it was going to be this hard. To, I'm confused on what I'm allowed to say. And I don't know who I should say it to. So there's some confusion at this point. But for those that decided to really do the work and dive in and say, this is a commitment beyond paper.
Right.
I'm still working with those companies. Mm-hmm. We're going on year two and a half. And everyone's at different places and procedures as part of their journey. But I'm now being added to onboarding so that new employees come in, understand what the commitment is, understand not to play catch up on some of the workshops we've done, but to understand that there's a language for which this company will use, understand how they will be able to continue to move forward in their career within the company. What does that look like? Who do you speak to?
So have you seen technology being an asset here, or do you find people hide behind it and you lose sort of that human capacity?
It's both. It's always an asset until it's not, right? Mm-hmm. Because it allowed us to continue to work these last, if we did not have the technology, what would we have done? But on the flip side, there were women that were told, go put on makeup, while men sat in pajamas and wrinkled shirts. There was a disparity of, I love Zoom for the simple fact that when they did all the backdrops and blurring, because you don't know what everyone has. And that helped even it a bit. So when you were telling people, turn on the cameras, it's disrespectful. Maybe they were sitting in their bathroom. Right. Maybe their house wasn't up to par that the part that they play when they're out. There's a lot of different things. So there was also a lot of people that did not have internet, was a luxury, wasn't a given. So there was that give and take of, it works well when it works.
So you saw the inequities. I mean, it was really glaring, pretty dramatic at that point. Would you say that there are some companies out there that have finally gotten it? Or do you think it's just still a, you know, passage that we're still in progress?
Oh, we're always going to be in progress because we're dealing with human beings. There's no end. You know, there is no yellow brick road to ending this. It is a ever growing, ever changing, ever shifting process. But yes, there are some companies that have made the commitment and have gotten it right and getting it right. And yes, they may misstep, but I haven't seen them misstep and falter in regards to, oh, we made a mistake, we won't do it again. They're like, we're committed to this and to getting it right.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of a human nature. We focus on something for 3 minutes and then we go on to the next shiny object. Do you see DEI as being that, or do you think it now is fully integrated into our culture that we actually always have to focus on it?
So diversity is race, gender, LGBTQ+, disability, sight seen and unseen, and veterans. I fight with the veterans, but that's the technical, so I'm going to leave that alone. Okay. Inclusion is how you build a ecosystem that voices are valued when they walk into a space. The equity is access. How do you get the raise? How do I learn more? How do I go through your ecosystem? Do you keep moving the pole for me? Go get another degree, go get another degree. Other people are passing you and there's no conversation. There's no way for you to move. How do you build and invest in someone? That's equity. It's access to the tools that are needed to succeed.
So Leslie, you have shared a great deal of knowledge about your experiences working with the CAVU Group. Is there some other important pearl of wisdom that you want to share with our audience?
Absolutely. I think people are so confused, as I was saying earlier, on what to do and which way to go. DEI is not the same work as doing racial equality work. They're kissing cousins. There's some similar conversations, but the work is not the same. And I think that gets very confusing that when people hear DEI, they only think brown or black folks, as opposed to race and gender and, like I said, disability, sight seen and unseen, LGBTQ+. Those are full conversations when you're dealing with DEI.
Do you have information on your website about this? And can you share your website?
The website is www.thecavugroup.com. And make sure you put the CAVU Group, because otherwise you're going to get a construction company that's not the same if you only put CAVU Group.
And I bet they get a lot of interesting questions in their daily operations.
As do I sometimes.
I'm sure you do.
I just put the tub in. I need to talk to you. Not here, you didn't.
And it would be fun if you started giving advice and they actually listened to that. So speaking of advice, what advice do you give yourself? You have realistically transformed your life so many times over, but how do you stay balanced, especially, you know, during this pandemic, during times of stress, during times of crisis? I know you're a chaplain, so you provide support and love and care to others. How do you do it for yourself?
My faith is very important to me, but I also get to do what I love to do. And that's to share what I know, but to keep learning, to push myself to always learn, look at something through a different eye, just be in the moment, plan ahead, whatever it is. Like I said, twirl. When I want to twirl, I work out every day. It's important for me to continue to speak to me and understand that every day is not going to be a great day, and that's okay. I'm not doing this for anyone else. I don't have anything I need to prove to anyone. At the end of this day, at the end of this life, I just want to maybe God to say to me, you did okay, kid, that I did no harm.
You did no harm, something that as docs we all know too well. And what I love is how you say every day is a new adventure. You're always exploring. You're always asking what is out there and how I can make a difference. What would be your one word of advice for someone who is a seven-year-old little girl trolling on her front porch and sees the world as her oyster?
The world is your oyster. You can go anywhere and do anything, but you do have to work. And I'll give the quote that's up in my office now, and I don't know who did this. God gave me the ability. My parents gave me the opportunity. Everything else I earned.
I love that. Thank you so much. It's inspirational and pragmatic. And you just see the beauty and everything that's inside us and in the world we're part of. Leslie, thank you so much for joining Always Searching today. It was such a joy and honor to have you with us. And for our listeners, until next time, we're always searching. Thank you so much for listening to Always Searching. Please share it with your community. This podcast was produced by Noah Jones and hosted by me, Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. Until next time, we're always searching.